Chapter 7. The Letter. In the previous chapter about the alchemical wedding of Christian Rosycross, we ascertained that the divine radiation power of the Gnosis is to be differentiated in three aspects. Firstly, the normative, secondly, the active, and thirdly, the creative aspect. It concerns three different potentials, three different vibrational waves, three different radiations that emanate from the immovable kingdom and penetrate into all branches of dialectical life. It is obvious that these different waves will also have three diverging effects in dialectical life. In the first wave, the ether forces, the astral forces, and the spinal forces are not in themselves in the least activated. Only a regrouping of these forces is brought about. For example, we see that through this stimulus, the two lower ethers decrease in their efficacy, and the two higher ethers, the light ether and the reflecting ether, take up a more dominant position, whereby especially the head and heart sanctuaries are touched. When this contact has become a fact, we notice in those who react, still wholly in keeping with their blood constitution and hereditary factors, a humanistic, artistic, religious, or intellectual reaction, or a combination of two of these characteristic ways of behavior. This touch is equally a call to the higher life, to actual liberation, a call initially understood and interpreted purely dialectically. A purely horizontal activity arises that is expressed in churches, humanistic organizations, artistic revelations, and in philosophical and scientific investigation. The people open to this are therefore enkindled by the Spirit of God, from which ensues the rich variety of movements we know so well in the life of society, in which we have all participated or still do participate. We set out with our whole mode of life from a certain dialectical idealism. It is seated in our blood, and the urge from it impels us through life with every breath and every heartbeat as a proof that we are called by God's Spirit. But take heed, this call mobilizes purely dialectical forces. Our potential for goodness is aroused by it. In other words, this effect also intensively enlivens the great opponent, namely evil. This call, this touch of the Gnosis and our reaction, ultimately results in a powerful energizing of the wheel of life, the rapid expenditure of forces, and the convulsions of rising, shining, and fading, as Jakob Boehme says in the book. Aurora. God made of this world a closed-off whole, so that life herein should turn like a wheel in a continuous grinding and breaking. Have you likewise experienced this divine touch as despair, even though it protects you from petrification? Do you know the stifling oppression of the unattainable? That none of your applied idealism achieves any positive result? When this realization is burned into you, then you are ripe for the second vibrational wave of the Gnosis. The second wave from the Brotherhood does not impel you to dialectical idealism. It is not merely a call that you try to answer in a spontaneous, natural way, but a seizing, an encounter, in which the voluntary element is primary. When the pupil is fit and ready to participate in this second touch, then forces are fed into him or her that are not explicable from ordinary nature. Try to understand this. As said previously, in the first wave, a regrouping of dialectical ethers develops, and the reflecting ether and light ether gain the upper hand, with all the consequences. In the second wave of vibration, we see the gradual development of an inability to assimilate the ordinary ethers and an opening of the system to the so-called holy ethers, the four holy foods. In the second vibrational wave, it starts with the chemical ether and continues up to and including the life ether, thus placing the emphasis on the two lower ethers. Try to form an image of the situation. The pure divine power induces you to action on the dialectical level, to embrace the highest pinnacle of goodness, the most splendid religious reflection, the most glorious artistic expressions and the loftiest scientific knowledge, you do this in keeping with your natural state of being, as your blood state permits. You then develop this whole activity led by a focal point of your personality, namely the consciousness centralized in the head sanctuary. Then you discover that your activities bring no liberating results. You experience a feeling of oppression because the ideals are unattainable, and a feeling of despair or distress because of the negative result. This is an extremely dangerous situation, for it can result in anatomical damage. In the sacred language, it says, "Deferred hope makes the heart ill." In other words, confrontation with the unattainable, and consequently sinking into despair, can result in a paralysis of activity, a state of dull resignation that brings with it an encapsulation of the consciousness. Anatomically, the medulla in particular is injured, and since the medulla controls the heart sanctuary, this condition literally draws the heart askew, which in turn brings about a total change in the respiratory functions. This series of events is not the end by far, for subsequently a change occurs in the lesser blood circulation, through which the pituitary and pineal gland secretions modify, finally resulting in a total darkening of the consciousness. So injury to the heart due to frustrated hope can cause a whole series of incidents. It is also possible, however, that the pupil who undergoes oppression due to the unreachable and discovers that his whole striving as to this world brings completely negative results, stops the drive of the I-being and distances himself, herself, from all dialectical impulsion, not in despair and distress, but in intelligent calmness, which the sacred language calls becoming still before God. In this silencing process, which we know by various names, the same course of events develops but with a completely different result. Likewise, it begins with the medulla. Becoming still before the gnosis opens the medulla for the second vibration wave. Becoming still before the gnosis, or looking to the hills from where the help must come, entails a specific attitude of the body, a certain sensorial state, a particular gaze, and a unique respiration at an unprecedented rhythm, changes that the pupil does not impose, but which arise out of the calm. These changes open the medulla like a cup to the Gnostic light. The heart is somewhat realigned from its lopsided state. New respiratory possibilities arise. The lesser blood circulation changes. Different internal secretions influence the nature of the blood, and new possibilities of consciousness start to come into effect. Through the change that began in the medulla, the new respiratory possibilities include the assimilation of ether forces of a higher vibration. These ether forces are of a chemical nature and initially cause a change in the brain cells. When these changes in the head sanctuary achieve a permanent effect, the pupil is anatomically, bodily, wholly open for the second power wave from the Brotherhood. As mentioned, this aims to prepare the candidate for rebirth. The Rosicrucians call this preparation submerging in Jesus the Lord. This means that the entire I-being with its personality, which has now attained the anatomical binding with the second Gnostic radiation, plunges bodily, calmly and without resistance, more and more into the Christ essence that has touched him, her, surrendering to it completely and intelligently. Humbly, he has communed with his Creator, as the Alchemical Wedding puts it. This is not to be seen as a purely mystical process. To the contrary, if anything influences the whole personality, it is this. Indeed, the depicted grip on the head sanctuary, the focal point of the consciousness, influences all the organs of the personality. The 12 pairs of cranial nerves descend from the head sanctuary into the whole body. Under the influence of the new chemical ether and the new life ether, the blood, the nerve fluid, and the consciousness are used to gradually withdraw the organism from the grip of dialectics. It is the fire of breaking up referred to in the sixth chapter. As this detaching, this submerging in Jesus, the Lord, progresses, a new psychological moment arrives on the candidate's homeward journey. He, she receives the invitation to the alchemical wedding. This invitation takes place in a special manner, as you have read. Christian Rosycross is tapped on the shoulder. He has the impression of a radiant being whose sky-blue garment is strewn with stars in an exceptional manner. The heavenly messenger carries a trumpet in her right hand, and on departing, gives such a strong blast on it that the entire hill on which Christian Rosycross dwells is shaken powerfully. He receives a letter sealed with the rose and cross, with the inscription, "In this sign you will conquer." This refers to the commencing touch of the third stream of the Gnosis, the touch of the Holy Spirit, the beginning of transfiguration. In the first stream, as we said, the dialectical forces are regrouped, whereby one discovers through experience that the earthly nature brings no solution whatsoever. In the second stream of the Gnosis, new ether forces of a higher vibration are fed into the pupil's system, from which the isolation of dialectical life in every atom of the personality becomes a fact. In the third touch, the personality now has to renew itself. It has to be reborn through the Holy Spirit. When this process begins, the pupil is tapped on the back, that is to say, a stream of power of an unknown potency and vibration touches the medulla anew and gushes down the serpent fire canal into the sacral plexus. This intense touch elevates the consciousness to the extent that the pupil experiences the second sidereal birth sensorially, like a shock. You probably know that the brain center carries an image of the starry host of the dialectical macrocosm as it was at the moment of material birth. This projection, this engraving of the dialectical macrocosm, determines many experiences and behaviors in life because it completely corresponds with the karmic results that the pupil carries in his, her aura. The moment the Holy Spirit, the third stream in the divine being, touches the pupil, the projections of the original macrocosm, the immovable kingdom, are bodily engraved in the pupil's brain center. So one can say the pupil is born a second time. But understand well, just as a newly born child is still helpless, organically powerless, and sensorially extremely limited, likewise the second sidereal birth is but a new fundamental beginning, a totally new basis for an ascent, a development in the original life. The moment the second sidereal birth has become a fact, the pupil beholds the messenger, not in the sense of an angel, a reflection sphere, light spirit, but he, she perceives the living reality of the approaching heavenly human being, the image of the original man, who is, who was, and who is to come, the first and the last. The pupil conceives an impression of the immovable kingdom in which there is neither beginning nor end. At that moment, there develops the exceptional and highly complicated situation where eternity and time interweave, the citizenship of two worlds, a world from which one takes leave as the earthly being, and a world that one enters, though as yet a still helpless being. Though helpless, however, the pupil is safe in God, in the gnosis that touches him. That is why the invitation that foretells the awakening in the new life has attached to it the sign of the holy rose and cross. A new auric field opens for the pupil, like a shining white garment, a radiant white rose, the white vesture of those saved by the Lamb. In this rose stands the golden cross of victory, the new personality is born. And, O inexpressible blessedness, in this sign the candidate will conquer.